Papa Johnson really used his ears, and he listened to everything that was going on around him, and he took in everything that was going on. All the popular musicians around him took their styles, and he took them off of other instruments and arranged them for his instruments, but, you know.
He's the first person we have from the blues world who had heard all the blues records. And as a result, he's the first person who doesn't just play a style from his place. He's like already this compendium of the greatest blues styles of the 20s and early 30s, and he's putting it all together.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And today is the second part of our two-part series featuring a discussion with Gail Dean Wardlow, Delta Blues historian, journalist, and of course, record collector. Now, on our previous episode, Mr. Wardlow told us stories about Charlie Patton, Willie Brown, H.C. Spear, and of course, Hayes McMullen, a blues musician whose music has only now been issued. And today, we're going to play a track of his on the show. And on this episode, Gail Dean Wardlow will talk to us about Robert Johnson, the stories, the rediscovery, his gravesite, his death certificate, and the pieces of the puzzle that we have through Mr. Wardlow's research work. And you could read heaps more in Gail Dean Wardlow's book, Chasing That Devil Music, available at Amazon.com. And of course, make sure to check out the album of original Delta Blues recordings by Hayes McMullen, Every Day Seem Like Murder Here, on Light in the Attic Records, available at lightintheattic.net. Today's episode is brought to you by Black Pug Records. If you want an original Australian vinyl pressing, check out the brilliant selection at Black Pug Records. Contact them at facebook.com/blackpugrecords. And we're also brought to you today by groovewasher.com. Dirty records are a sin. Repent and redeem yourself by getting a Groove Washer record cleaning system at groovewasher.com. And with that, let's start our conversation with Gail Dean Wardlow on the history and legend of bluesman Robert Johnson.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
All righty. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Another episode of The Vinyl Guide, podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And we're getting ready to go into the Easter holiday. So I hope everyone's prepared. Hope everyone's got some plans and having fun. Whether or not you celebrate Easter, just remember, any day is a great reason to eat chocolate. So, you know, don't let not celebrating Easter stop you from eating chocolate. And also keep in mind, Easter is Sunday, which makes Monday half-price chocolate day. So make sure you put that in your calendar as well. This is the second of our two-part series on the Delta Blues and our interview with Gail Dean Wardlow. Now, last week we spoke to Mr. Wardlow about his record collecting bug, how he built up this fantastic Blues 78 collection in the early 60s simply by knocking on doors of people in the Deep South, and then how he started piecing together the stories of the Delta Blues and the musicians and the people behind them. Now, these are great stories, so make sure you listen to last week's episode to hear about those tales, as well as talk about Charlie Patton, H.C. Spear, and of course, Hayes McMullen. Now, this week is part two of that discussion. Gail Dean Wardlow has such a rich history in researching the Delta Blues, you can't fit it all into a single episode. So rather than making one like 2.5 hours long, I pulled the sections where he spoke about Robert Johnson and put those in today's episode. Now, there's no doubt that Robert Johnson is the most well-known and most mysterious pre-war bluesman in history. And a lot of what we know about Robert Johnson is because of the research work from Gail Dean Wardlow. Now, today we're going to focus on Robert Johnson as well as share a track from the Hayes McMullen Every Day Seem Like Murder Here LP. Original recordings, all cleaned up and sounding beautiful from Light in the Attic Records. Pick one up from your local record shop or at lightintheattic.net. All right, and one last thing. Please make sure to leave the Vinyl Guide podcast a positive review on iTunes. A lot of work goes into this. each week. So, you know, if you like this show, if you listen to this show, that's great. Glad to have you on board. Subscribe and share and tell your friends about it. But also, if you could do us the big solid favor of leaving a positive review on iTunes, that would be most awesome. Alrighty, let's get into part two of our two-part series on the Delta Blues with our interview with Gale Dean Wardlow. Today he's going to talk about the legend of Robert Johnson. Right after this. Hey everyone, there is a record shop that you all need to know about.
Black Pug Records. Black Pug Records.
Can be found online at facebook.com/Black Pug Records. Now the shop itself is in Islington, New South Wales, which is in Newcastle. So anyone around Sydney or the Newcastle area can easily get to
Black Pug Records
and walk in and check it all out for yourself. But here's why our national and international listeners should know about
Black Pug Records.
And that's because
Black Pug Records
has a regular supply of killer original pressing Australian vinyl. Get yourself the AC/DC original pressings on Albert Productions, which you've always wanted. Or pick up an OG Midnight Oil, or In Excess, Crowded House, Angels, or Cold Chisel pressings. All original and ready to ship worldwide. Get original Australian punk records from Hard-Ons or Meanies or Nick Cave or Psych Collectibles like Mountains of Madness or Spectrum Part 1. If you want an original Australian pressing vinyl, the shop to call is
Black Pug Records.
Like them on Facebook at facebook.com/Black Pug Records. That's facebook.com/Black Pug Records. The one-stop shop for original Australian vinyl. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we've got a major announcement from GrooveWasher.com. Now, most of you know GrooveWasher.com is the number one manual record cleaning system on the market today. But what you may not know is they've just introduced a brand new GrooveWasher starter kit. Now, you and your friends can get a GrooveWasher record cleaning starter kit for just $29.95. Holy smokes, as if the GrooveWasher product couldn't get any better, now there's a starter kit that's going to cost you less than the cost of new records. And if you have a record collection, either large or small, you will need to keep your records clean. Dirty records are a great way to ruin the records and your equipment, so make sure you have a record cleaner of some sort. Sure, there are expensive record machines that can do the job, but geez Louise, some of them cost up to $1,000 or more. For those of us who need to stretch our dollars, there's GrooveWasher.com. Now, for less than $30, you can get a record cleaning kit that will ensure you hear your records at their best and make them last the longest. Plus, you record retailers can now stock the GrooveWasher kit in your store. Check out GrooveWasher.com for more details. So get the very best manual record cleaning system on Earth, and likely Mars and Jupiter too. Pick up the GrooveWasher today at GrooveWasher.com, starting at only $29.95. That's GrooveWasher.com, and they are made in the USA. Alrighty, so before we continue our conversation with Gale Dean Wardlow on the life and history and legend of Robert Johnson, let's do a quick track from the Hayes McMullen album, Every Day Seem Like Murder Here. Now, this track is called Kansas City Blues. I think it's about one of 15 or so tracks from the album, Every Day Seem Like Murder Here. And again, this is a direct recording from an original, authentic Delta blues musician from the 1930s. These tracks were recorded, I think, in 1968, and this whole LP is perhaps the only place where you can hear original, authentic Delta blues recorded by an original Delta blues musician with this sort of high quality. All right. Now, this is a two-record set from the original tapes. Comes with this big, beautiful booklet. There's pictures. There's the full story and everything. And it really is a beautiful package. And it's a limited run on vinyl. So make sure you get one before they sell out. Try to pick one up from your local record shop. It's always good to support those guys. If you can't find one locally, you can always grab one from lightintheattic.net. But act fast. All right. Here we go. Hayes McMullen.
I woke up this morning feeling bad. Thought about the good times I once have had. I'm gonna move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move, baby. Honey, why they don't lie you? Well, a wet up man started down Beale, looking for the woman that they called Lucille. She done moved to Kansas City. She done moved to Kansas City. She done moved, baby. Honey, why they don't like you? Well, Mississippi River's so deep and wide. Have a good gal on that other side. She done moved to Kansas City. She done moved to Kansas City. She done moved, baby. Honey, why they don't like you? Well, I know my woman, she gon' jump and shout. Train roll up, I come stepping out. She done moved to Kansas City. She done moved to Kansas City. She done moved, baby. Honey, why they don't like you? Well, I went to the river, couldn't get across. Seen my little girl, and I started to crawl. I'ma move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move, baby. Honey, where they don't like. Well, it's T for Texas, T for Tennessee. Oh, we've got Mississippi, and the women wants me. I'm gonna move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move, baby. Honey, why they don't like.
Let's talk about Hayes McMullen here in a moment. First, let's quickly deviate over to Robert Johnson. When you were going through the record crates as a young man on the doorsteps, and you found those Robert Johnsons, you took them home, you listened to Robert Johnson, you knew it was unique. When did you realize that Robert Johnson's work was important?
Well, you know, I knew he was good. You know, after I'd heard, you know, I heard a couple of records, and I found, you know, a copy of the first album and listened to it. You know, and so some of it, but I thought Charlie Patton's was a lot better. I thought the guys from the 20s like Patton and Son House and Skip James, you know, they were originators of their styles. And, of course, what Johnson is doing, Johnson's the best guitar player of the 1930s because, you know, he learned so much and he picked up anything he could from any other musician. And, you know, the lyrics, I think, you know, five or six Johnson sides are fantastic. But, you know, but there's a lot of stuff that's just average. But, you know, his Delta stuff like Crossroad Blues and Rambling on My Mind, Come On in My Kitchen, you know. As Bernie Klesko said, he made four or five really top-notch songs. And, you know, the movie Crossroads brought about, you know, that myth of the devil thing. And then the record company came out in 1990 with that box set, you know, and they used that devil myth to really, you know, get his name out there, and that more people know the name of Robert Johnson than Charlie Patton or anybody else. You know, he has a world famous name, but, you know, in my opinion, it's like, as Bernie Klesko used to say, he said, you got to look back to the people who started Charlie Patton, Skip James, Son House, those guys. They were the originators of individual styles, and, you know, Johnson's, by the time Charlie Patton is playing, Robert Johnson was 1 year old. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that's, I think it's harder for people to get into Charlie Patton because his dialect. And also, those Paramount recordings were very poorly recorded, you know, as far as quality. But, you know, you can't hear, you hear the guitar, but I mean, you know, Johnson had the advantage of being recorded when they had much better electrical equipment. And they could take the masters and, you know, rework them and really make them sound great, whereas you can just do so much with Charlie Patton. But I was the person who found the death certificate on Johnson. You know, I remember I mentioned to you I put in for four death certificates, and they missed Johnson. They missed him because I put the wrong county. In those days, you had to write down, you know, a five-year period. The person died, the county, they died in. Well, I put down, I believe, Quitman County, which is up in Robinsonville. Or that, well, what is that? Robinsonville, whatever the county is, I forget it now.
Well, when you were filling it out, you had no idea where he died or how he died. You were just you just took taking shots in the dark. I was digging.
I was amazed that Mississippi had kept death certificates on black blues musicians, you know, like Patton and Tommy Johnson and Willie Brown. It amazed me. And they had on Johnson. See, then I went back 3 years later when I read an interview in a magazine that someone said he died. I believe it was Honey Boy Edwards said he died in Greenwood. So I immediately go back to the health department and say, you know, look under LaFleur County. And I said, this guy was a great musician. I said, find him dead for me this time.
You didn't try looking in the phone book? You
didn't. No. But I told her, I said, find this guy. He's dead. Find him dead this time, please. And by golly, 3 days later, I got a letter from, and I opened it with trembling hands. There it was, Robert Lee Johnson.
Wow.
August 16, 1938. And that particular death certificate was published way back in 1971 in the London magazine, or the English magazine of Blues Unlimited.
Now, before we jump to that, let's just say you got the death certificate, but there was a front side and a back side, right?
I didn't get the backside in 1968, believe it or not. They never gave it to me. I didn't know it was there. And two other people got the backside. And it was 1996 before I realized there must be more. And I went back to them and said, please look and see if there's anything on the back. And they sent it to me. That was where, you know, she talked, Miss Jordan talked to the plantation owner. And it created a lot more questions, you know, in a lot of ways. The backside of the death certificate, but, you know, the guy, Jim Moore, was an informant. And, you know, one or two researchers thought there was no Jim Moore. But I tracked a woman who knew the Jim Moore on the plantation where Johnson died. So
real quick, there's a lot of detail and a lot of real interesting facts and color into this story in Gail's book, Chasing That Devil Music, which you could buy on Amazon and just about anywhere. If you're interested in understanding the details around Robert Johnson's death certificate and all the different elements around it, make sure you check out that book. And plus, there's a lot of other very interesting blues tales, some deep dives on Charlie Patton and Son House, and of course, Hayes McMullen as well. But just so folks who are listening to this know, the front side of Robert Johnson's death certificate lists what you would expect them to list, you know, date of death and you know, some different reasons. But on the back side, it's more commentary from the doctors and from the investigation around the death, right?
Right.
Okay. And what sort of elements did that backside illuminate in the whole story of Robert Johnson?
Well, that is more confusion in a sense, because there was one researcher, McCormick, down in Texas, and he got a copy of the death certificate, but it was like 5 years after me, and he got the backside. So he went to Greenwood and, you know, went out on the plantation where Johnson died. But he was the one that, you know, said that later on, you know, he thought Jim Moore didn't exist. It was a made-up name because, you know, they thought Johnson was murdered, but they actually was a Jim Moore. We tracked that down in later years, and actually found the woman whose husband dug Johnson's grave and interviewed her on tape, you know, and so forth. And she was at home, you know, and plantation owner Luther Wade came over and knocked on the door and said, get your husband to go up to the cemetery and dig a grave. We got this guy who died over here this morning and you know, so-and-so's house. And so her husband went up and dug the grave in Little Zion Baptist Church, and she took him water up there, and they went to the county barn and got a pine box and brought the pine box back put Johnson in the pine box and buried him that very same morning. That was a Tuesday. He died early on Tuesday morning, and he was buried by, you know, noon or a little later. And what you got to realize is that in those days, people would start stinking. Mm-hmm. You know, if you didn't do...
They start stinking now, by the way, too.
Oh, what? Okay. Well, yeah. So,
that still
so in those
happens.
Days, you know, yeah, poor whites, poor blacks, you know, poor white, poor black. You know, you just buried a guy the same day. You know, sometime they put your body up in the house on a board, and that's where that expression on the cooling board comes from.
Mm.
You know, a lot of slang, but Son House sang about on the cooling board, but they buried Johnson the same day he died. And then, you know, there's still some unanswered questions, you know, about did he really die from poison or did he die from medical conditions he had?
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I've got thoughts about it, but we've got it in the manuscript. It's at a publisher right now.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I don't want to give away the more information, but we've got it pretty well nailed what killed Johnson. And let's say it this way, the poison he supposedly got in his drink did not kill him.
Oh, okay.
That was not the primary reason he died.
So you're certain, without revealing kind of what's in an upcoming book, you're certain you know how Robert Johnson died?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay. Now let's talk.
Basically, I can say this. He bled to death.
Oh.
He bled to death, in other words. And he also, a month before he came to Greenwood, he had been to see a doctor in Memphis with stomach problems.
Okay.
See, and nobody knew that, in other words. But, if you play a juke and you get sick, everybody just assumes you've been poisoned. And it's very possible, you know, something was put in his moonshine. But he lived 3 days, you know, after that Saturday night. He lived the Tuesday morning. So, but, you know, when we get a publication for the book, you call me back, and Nate, we'll talk another hour.
So with Robert Johnson, of course, he's buried at that Zion Church. We pretty much believe definitively that's where his resting place is, yeah? No other question.
Yeah, here's the problem. The death certificate I found, it said burial, Zion Church. Well, about 1989, somebody found, they were looking in LaFleur County, and there was a Mount Zion Baptist Church, Black Baptist Church, right down from an old house they claim was a juke house. So they determined that this Mount Zion must be where Johnson was buried. But Sony Records came down and they paid, you know, for a monument at this Mount Zion. And I questioned it. And I questioned it for one reason. If you are a musician and you're playing in Greenwood and you die in Greenwood and you're a pauper, why would they take you 10 miles down in the country to bury you? Doesn't make any sense, does it? So what happened is in 10 years later, you know, around 2000, through contacts, I find this woman named Rosie Eskridge, who lived on Luther Wade's Star of the West plantation. That's where Johnson died. In other words, and she said, well, yeah, my husband dug the grave. It's that church right up there. It's called Little Zion Baptist Church. But see, the death certificate was misleading. It didn't say Little Zion. It just said Zion Church. And she dug the grave. She took me and my friend Ace Atkins, who's a novelist, up there and showed us exactly where under the tree where her husband dug the grave and Johnson was buried. So that, you know, that monument Sony put up is still down there, you know, it last time I heard, but now there's a monument, you know, a big grave marker there in Little Zion Baptist Church.
So most likely that Little Zion Church is the place where he's.
Well, there's no doubt because, you know, this Rosie Eskridge, you know, she was living on the plantation and she knew Jim Moore personally. She knew, all she said I knew was this man, they called him a bluesman. So I never heard him sing. I never saw him. But Mr. Wade got my husband to dig his grave. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind he's buried there at that Little Zion Baptist Church. It's about 3 miles west out of Greenwood on Money Road. But that's, you know, and, you know, the confusion was that it said Zion Church on the death certificate, and they found the Zion Church. And the people, you know, put it on. And Sony came in, you know, and helped with the marker.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that in those days, you know, that's what everybody thought. But I always questioned it because, again, if you're a pauper, don't have much money, and you die in Greenwood, they would have carried you to a city cemetery for paupers in Greenwood and buried you there. They wouldn't take you 10 miles down in the country to bury you in a church cemetery.
Not on a hot southern day. Certainly not.
No. No, I mean, you know, they say Johnson died penniless. I think he made a little bit of money probably playing that night, you know, at Saturday night and so forth. But he was renting a room in Babelstown, which is the black section of Greenwood.
Now, through your research and detective work, you've been able to piece together all these different facts and stories and really color the history of blues. You're a guy who they come to when they have new information. And every couple years we hear about a new Robert Johnson photo coming up. What are your thoughts? Are there any other photos of Robert Johnson out there?
The only two photos that really are of Robert Johnson are the two that's been found. The one in the suit with the guitar made at Hook Brothers, and the one taken in a little, where you drop in a nickel a dime, they take a photo. Mm-hmm. The reason I know this is because I have been in touch for the last, 5 to 10 years with one of Robert Johnson's last remaining relatives. She's 88 years old, and she was a niece. And she was raised by Carrie Thompson, who was Robert's half-sister. And those two photos are authentic. She was there as a young girl when he went down to take the photo in Memphis at Hook Brothers in the suit with a guitar. And she confirms that, you know, that is real. The other photo with a cigarette in his mouth, that's real. The rest of them, no. I mean, they come up with an idea, this is Robert Johnson, and they hope it is because they hope to make a lot of money off of it.
Sure.
But that's the only two authentic photos of Johnson.
There's rumor of a third that Peter Gralnick mentioned.
Yeah,
Mac McCormick.
A guy named Mac McCormick lived in Houston, and I used to correspond some with Mac. Went by to see him one time in the late 90s. He told me, first he denied the photo he was shown, he got it from Carrie Thompson, who was Johnson's half-sister, like in 1975, she was still alive. And he got a photo of Johnson and his nephew just standing beside a car. That's what he showed Guralnick. Then when I came by there, he said, well, I've had a burglary, and all my pictures are gone. And he denied. Then he also denied that he ever really had a third photo of Johnson. I don't know where it is. No one knows where that photo has never been published. And, you know, because, number one, McCormick didn't send it back, I can tell you that. Because this lady I talked to, you know, they were trying to get the photos back. He even took photos of her mother, of Robert's mother, and so forth like that. But I don't know the status. McCormick died about a year ago. He claimed he didn't have the photo after, you know, Guralnick's the only person he ever showed it to, and he told me he had a burglary, and he didn't have that photo. And he denied having any photos of Johnson to me and everybody else. So, you know, no one knows. No one knows where that photograph is.
Very strange. So the small one with the cigarette, that the one where they used on the postage stamp,
you know, you used to have little nickel and dime photo shops, you know. You sit down on a seat, and it would take your picture, your headshot. Mm-hmm. And they had them in stores, in other words. It might cost you a dime or something like that, the photo. And the half-sister had that photo, too. Robert had a half-sister called Carrie Thompson. And that was her married name. And she was about 5 years older than Robert. And she was living up in Maryland when she was found by McCormick, then later found by a guy named Levere. In other words, did a contract deal with her for 50% of royalties, you know, on the Johnson estate he could make. But that's the only two photos, you know, that's it. You know, people come up, there's been at least two more examples of photos where they think it's Johnson or they claim it's Johnson, and it's not. There's no way, you know, they showed it to people like Honey Boy Edwards or Robert Lockwood, and he said, no, that's not Robert. But everybody, you know, thinking big money if I can find a photo of Robert Johnson.
Now, what's interesting is Robert Johnson not only recorded a lot of music that was released, but there were alternate takes as well. How were those stored throughout the years? I mean, I'd normally think those would be thrown away.
Yeah. Well, in, by most cases, by 1960, when they, you know, in 1970, they put those two first albums together. When they started looking in 1960, they went to the files and pulled the original master, and they, or metal parts, they call it, and they had certain metal parts. Here's the situation. In the 20s and 30s, the record companies did this. They made you record two takes of each song. The reason was because they shipped the masters back to New York, okay? If one master gets damaged somehow, then you still got one take, then you still got the other take you can put out. So what happened is they did this with everybody they recorded. And what metal masters, what masters they had, they used those, and they had to borrow some 78s because they did not have some of the metal parts, you know, left of Johnson's stuff. A lot of it, for instance, over at Vocalion, there were about 20 Charlie Patton songs that were recorded, and they had been destroyed by the 60s. And the numbers had been reassigned to a series of Chinese music.
Yeah.
So they always did two takes in those days. All you Western swing guys, you know, Bob Wills, Milton Brown, Roy Acuff and country. I talked to him a lot about Spear. You know, Spear told me we always did two takes. And that way you got a safety take and you get back to New York City. You press up, you know, both takes and you decide which one you're going to issue. So Vocalion, what they would do sometime, they'd issue, say, take one of Crossroad Blues, and after a stamper, and a stamper could stamp up to 1,200 copies, or more like 900 copies, then they'd go back and keep using the stamper until maybe it worn out, and they'd go pull the other take out and put it out. So that's why you got, you know, double takes on some songs of Johnson and others. You, for instance, as far as I know, there's only one take made of Sweet Home Chicago. Don't know why there should have been a second take, but there's nothing in the record files, you know, about there being two takes of Sweet Home Chicago.
Wow. Okay. So sometimes those second takes were used to actually press records. You could buy two records from the same artist and they're different versions.
Yeah. Well, see, if you go look at that box set of Johnson's that came out in 1990, and they had, you know, at that time, then they had something around 2010.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they had all the different takes, you know, on there. So there were five, six, seven songs where they were different, you know, two takes. Crossroad Blues has got two takes, you know, where he talks about Willie Brown. In the Run Tell My Friend Willie Brown. And the other take he says, Run Tell My Friend Poor Willie Brown. But that was common. In other words, everybody, you did one song, then you did the song again a second time, then you moved on to the next song. And, you know, they don't. Now, somebody like Bing Crosby or somebody like Frank Sinatra, yeah, if they made two or three takes, they kept those takes because they were big artists.
Right.
But, you know, a guy like Johnson, he's just to Columbia Records, who recorded him, you know, he's just another guy.
Just taking up shelf space.
Yeah, you know, really. So that's the, you know, and of course, the tragedy of all this is Paramount. And I'll put this in for you. Paramount thought nothing of what they had. They sold off all their metal masters in World War II for, you know, money. Their collection, you know, they were collecting steel, collecting metal. They sold it off as scrap metal, all their masters. And they threw away all their paper files to the war drive for paper.
They were good patriots, but bad historians.
Well, they just had, they had the greatest talent because Spears sent them the best talent out of Mississippi. You know, and they Paramount just has the best talent. You know, when you get Blind Blake and Blind Lemon, and then you got Charlie Patton, you know, and you got all the Delta guys. Blind Lemon sold as many records as anybody in the 20s, and Blind Blake. Those guys sold records tremendous, as good as any guitar players recorded. They sold more records than anybody.
Mr. Wardlow, your history and your detective work has really been so instrumental in preserving the blues and the legacy that became rock and roll. I think the field of music would look so different if it weren't for your hard work and knocking on doors and seeking those facts back in the 60s and up to current day. So, Mr. Wardlaw, I really do want to thank you for all your great work, for spending time with us today. And again, folks who want to hear more, make sure to pick up the Hayes McMullen Everyday Seemed Like Murder Here LP at lightintheattic.net. And also check out Mr. Wardlaw's book, Chasing That Devil Music, Searching for the Blues, available on Amazon and any place that fine books are sold. All right. Well, there we go. Mr. Gail Dean Wardlaw, ladies and gentlemen, blues historian, author, journalist, record collector, friend of the show, and all-around good guy. We salute you for all your work, Mr. Wardlaw, and thanks for doing all that. We wouldn't know much about any of these blues musicians if it wasn't for the work that Gail Dean Wardlaw did, specifically in the 60s and 70s and 80s, finding all those people to talk to and piecing that history together. We are a better musical species because of the work of Gail Dean Wardlaw. Again, if you want to know more, pick up Gail Dean Wardlaw's book, Chasing That Devil Music. You can get it today on Amazon.com or a used bookshop. It's been out for a while, so you can probably find one around here or there, maybe even in the local library, so check there as well. Also, make sure to check out a copy. Get yourself a copy of the Hayes McMullen album, Every Day Seem Like Murder Here, available from your local record shop or from lightintheattic.net. Get one before they all sell out. All right, well, that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. I think I'm going to be taking next week off. Going to have a nice Easter. I hope you guys do the same. Relax, have fun with the family, eat a lot of chocolate, and we'll get back together when we're all 5 pounds heavier with a brand new episode of The Vinyl Guide podcast. All right, until next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.